On this edition of the DFA podcast, we talk about the mess that is the Mets, as well as some other minor signings and trades from across the league. The hot stove is definitely not lit, but we're coming at you anyway. It's the DFA podcast.
Welcome to episode 44 of the DFA podcast. I'm your host, Brian Grossnick, and joining me today is my fellow co-host, regular appearer on the show, at least last year, RJ Anderson. RJ, thanks for coming back in 2018. I was starting to get worried about you.
I thought you had non-tendered me, to be honest with you.
RJ will never be DFA'd from this podcast, and I wouldn't even dream of it, RJ. I think it's much more likely that you will head to Korea or head to Japan on your own volition rather than being cut loose by us. Joining us also is Sean Brody, our producer and man on the street. He's been checking things out for us on the trade and transaction wires, and as some great items for us in the C block where we're going to talk through our batting practice. We got lots to go over today, right, Sean?
Oh, yeah, we have all of about five trades that have happened or five moves that have happened in the last like 3 weeks, so yeah, real riveting stuff.
So maybe Sean's fired. We'll keep RJ. Sean's got to go. No, it's not your fault. It's collusion. I refuse to blame anybody involved in this except for the ownership of Major League Baseball franchises.
Can second that. RJ, you get behind that?
Yes.
It's agreed.
All right. So we'll call the commissioner's office. We'll let everyone know. We do have one big move. A lot of the other moves that we're going to talk about today are, you could say, on the smaller side, or you could say on the super, super tiny side in many cases. But we do have one big move. We have one that we want to bring in Sean to talk about because, as a going concern of this podcast, it does include the New York Mets. Tough luck to any of you who are tired of hearing Sean and I complain about the Mets, because our big move of the day is Jay Bruce re-signing, kind of a little bit of both after ending the season with the Indians, but he is returning to the Mets on a three-year, $39 million contract. And before I get into my thoughts on it, before we let Sean have his horribly biased, slanted, Mets-focused comments, RJ, we're going to give you first crack at this one from your man-on-the-street perspective, your outsider perspective. Tell us what you think about the Jay Bruce signing.
I like the idea here that, you know, I can offer my, you know, 30 seconds of thoughts on Jay Bruce's signing, and then I can duck out and let you all talk for like 10, 15 minutes. And then when I come back, I know we'll still be talking about the Mets, so I won't have missed anything whatsoever.
Yeah, it gives you a nice little break to get one for something.
Exactly. You know, the contract itself is fine. I think it is a little bit of an unusual fit, because it's always going to be an unusual fit for the Mets outfield. It doesn't seem like they're necessarily big believers in having a true center fielder. I know Juan Lagares is still around, but it doesn't seem like he'll be an everyday or even most day presence in the lineup. So, yeah, you're getting Bruce. You're potentially using him a little bit at first base as well. So that's kind of interesting, and you kind of wonder what that means for Dominic Smith, not only in the short term but also the long term, because you would think at this point, if they're not going to give him a look, well, when are they going to give him a look? And I guess it's also interesting from the perspective that the Mets are rumored to be interested in bringing back a lot of players who began last season with them, and obviously last season was not a particularly successful one for the Mets, so you kind of question the logic of bringing the band back together when your last album was a complete bust and you were, you know, trading band members at the deadline. I guess that analogy really kind of fell apart there, didn't it? But the point is, it's an interesting move for those reasons, and I don't know that any of those reasons are particularly the right kind of interesting if you're trying to build a winning team. But, you know, Jay Bruce is a good source of power. Here's a statistic for you, actually. I meant to bring this up from the jump, but this is a statistic that I found last summer that really shocked me, and it's that Jay Bruce leads all active players who are 30 years old or younger in career home runs. I had no idea. So, you know, he's nearing the 300 mark. He's probably going to get to 300, I would say, this season, because he's consistently above 20 home runs and he's 23 to do it. But yeah, he's, you know, fairly limited as far as his defensive capabilities, and he's not really an everyday player. He's a platoon guy who's going to play most days, but that's about all he is, and that's fine. I just don't know that it necessarily changes the outlook of the Mets too much, and I don't know what else they're going to do this winter to really change their outlook.
All of those are really great points. If you were to look at Bruce outside the context of the Mets, do you think that this is a pretty reasonable deal in terms of average annual value? What do you kind of expect from him in terms of his offense, kind of just generally speaking, before we talk any more about, you know, how weird of a fit it is with the New York Metropolitans?
Yeah, I think the deal is fine. If anything, you know, you could argue maybe he's being underpaid, because he's consistently been above average hitter, especially against right-handed pitchers when he's been healthy. And, you know, you can explain away some of his inconsistency over the last, you know, 4 or 5 seasons because of his knee injuries. And, you know, the last 2 years he's posted OPS pluses of 113 and 115. And yes, there's been some down time in there. For instance, you know, when he first came over to the Mets, he was pretty miserable for like a 50-game stretch. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we all know that sometimes we look too far into these things and we look for patterns and trends that perhaps are not real and are perhaps just, you know, figments of having, you know, a 50-game cameo for the Mets, or having, you know, split seasons where he played 43 games for the Indians. So I think he'll be an above-average hitter. I know there's obviously some attrition risk later in the deal because, you know, anytime you're talking about a guy with this kind of profile, you certainly wonder about that later, as he enters his mid-30s. But, yeah, based on where I'm sitting, if you put this in a vacuum, it's a fine deal. It's probably even a goodish deal. And I think he'll be an above-average hitter, again, against right-handed pitching. And it's just a weird fit, like I said. And that's probably my biggest point of contention with the deal.
So one quick thing I want to bring up about your wonderful statistic about Jay Bruce having the most home runs of anybody under 30 last season. He's aged out of that group. He's going into his age 31 season next year. But Giancarlo Stanton almost caught him last year, which is kind of unsurprising, but still kind of crazy. He got up to 267 homers by the end of the season, where Bruce finished out with 277. So I agree with you completely. I think he's going to pass that 300 mark next year without breaking too much of a sweat. So, Sean, let's talk about it from the Mets perspective. So RJ called it kind of a weird fit. As somebody who's followed the Mets pretty carefully over the last couple of years, talk a little bit about the fit and the idea of the Mets bringing back somebody who is a former Met and how that's kind of what the team does.
So I wanted to not like the deal. Well, first of all, the money that Bruce signed for is he deserves that. He probably deserves more than that. I think MLB trade rumors pegged him at around $41 million. He ended up getting $39 million. He could have gotten more, but I think Craig Goldstein summed it up really well, and I think RJ summed it up in his kind of talking with it. If you believe that Bruce is not going to be dealing with his knee injuries, or he had a neck thing last year, I believe, then it's a good deal, and he even has some upside on this deal. But if you believe that the injuries are going to plague him going forward, then of course the Mets aren't going to really see any value from this deal. So I like it. I've turned the corner on Jay Bruce in terms of my liking his play. I think it fits well for the beginning of the season, at least, when we don't know if Conforto is alive. So, I mean, you need somebody to play that role. Bruce is certainly that guy. You want to, as a Mets fan and stuff, you want to see new guys coming in sometimes, and you want to see like some kind of change year to year. You're not going to get that this offseason. It's kind of rough because, I mean, that's what you want, but they're not going to go out and sign a J.D. Martinez. As much as Lorenzo Cain would be awesome, they're not going to do that. He was the best option that there was, probably, but at the same time, he is what he is, and he's always going to have those questions about his health. He's always going to deal with that stuff, and who really knows how it's going to go. I would have liked to have seen them go out and maybe be a little more aggressive at a Lorenzo Cain, but at the same time, Jay Bruce is younger than Lorenzo Cain, even though Cain plays a better outfield than Bruce does. So, yeah.
So here's the thing that I want to kind of get to for this. So Bruce is slightly younger than Lorenzo Cain, sure. The thing is, Bruce is a good free agent in this market. I had him as the 14th best free agent on the market. I had him as the third best outfielder behind J.D. Martinez and Lorenzo Cain. The problems that I seem to have with Jay Bruce, and again, I agree with you guys, the contract is fine. The problem seems to be that the Mets roster composition doesn't really lend itself well to a left-handed hitting corner outfielder slash first baseman in a vacuum. So right now, obviously they need a right fielder of some kind, or they need a corner outfielder or center fielder of some kind, because right now their outfield probably consists of Bruce, Cespedes, and some combination of Juan Lagares and Brandon Nimmo. And without Bruce, it would have been really bad, because then you would have had Lagares as an everyday player. He's probably not good enough to be an everyday player. You would have had Nimmo as an everyday player. They work much better as a platoon, even if it is in center field. And you've got Bruce in right field. And so bringing in a corner outfielder or a center fielder was always going to be a good option for this team. The thing that I have some trouble with is that, as somebody who's very down on Dominic Smith, the best possible option to me that the team could have brought in would have been a right-handed hitting outfielder slash first baseman. And I know that's the soft side of a platoon, and I know it's not a player that's going to be hitting as frequently because there are fewer left-hand pitchers than right-handed pitchers than a left-handed bat. But I think that would have been a useful guy to bring in so that you could kind of test out Smith for a little bit longer at first base, while having a platoon partner to keep him off the field against, you know, good left-handed pitchers. And then also somebody who could play right field or center field and hit right-handed and fill in the outfield. With Bruce, he'll be fine as the starting right fielder for a while, but at some point Michael Conforto is going to come back. And what we hope. If Conforto moves to center field, where he's playing out of position, he's probably not a very good center fielder. The Mets could very well have one of the worst defensive outfields in baseball. In addition to that, the other option would be to move Jay Bruce to first base, where he can't really platoon with Dominic Smith. He would be a replacement for Dominic Smith at first base. Now, if you're like me and you don't buy into Dominic Smith as an everyday first baseman, no problem. Play Jay Bruce at first base. He's probably going to be a fine defensive first baseman. He didn't look awful out of position in like 100 innings there last year. But if you do want to see Dominic Smith play more, I find this is a really kind of a nice short-term move, but it looks really wonky for 2018 and like halfway through the season and beyond. I don't know. What do you kind of think about that, RJ? I'm gonna interrupt your lunch so that you can comment on that. But do you think, as terms of a fit, the Mets would have been better suited trying to get maybe even a similar-ish player, if one such exists? Maybe that would have been like Todd Frazier, who hits right-handed, or, I don't know, somebody else. Not quite going up to the Cane tier, but getting somebody who's a right-handed hitter. Or do you think this is, you know, kind of the best available guy, so they had to go out and get him?
I do have one thing to say about Cane before I get into that, and it's that I think if I were going to sign one of the Royals free agents, regardless of money, Cane would be my guy. Mm-hmm. I just really like his game, but no, what you said about getting a right-handed sock makes a lot of sense, and it kind of goes back to what I said earlier. I'm not really sure what the Mets intend to do with Dominic Smith. I don't know if they're ever going to give him a shot, because, you know, this would seem to be the year to do it, when the team is not necessarily expected to be highly competitive. You're kind of coming potentially to the end of the Washington Nationals' dominance, so, you know, maybe use this as a bridge year, and then, all systems go for a 2019 run, but what you said makes a lot of sense. And, you know, Todd Frazier would have made a lot of sense for them, and you figure he probably would have required a deal that's, if not similar to this one, probably somewhat similar to this one in terms of the AAV and whatnot. And, you know, in general, I think Frazier is actually an underrated player on this market, because everybody focuses on his age, and I get it. But if you had to tell me who you would rather have over the next 2 or 3 years, you know, between Frazier and Moustakas, you know, who you think is going to be more productive, ignore the contracts, you know, who are you taking? Because I think I would take Frazier.
Wow, that's pretty strong. For me, like, the guy that jumped out at me was former Mets concern, but never a guy who made the team in the end, was Carlos. Well, He was a former Mets concern, and they almost brought him back. So he is a guy who knows the clubhouse, and that's Carlos Gomez, as a right-handed hitting outfielder who they could put in right field. And, you know, of course, they could try to move him to first base if they wanted him to cover Smith as a platoon guy, but that's not necessarily something they would do. Or, you know, longstanding Sean Brody concern, Howie Kendrick, they could have put him in the outfield and then moved him to first base. And he's got that position flexibility. He could also do other things even. The thing is, Jay Bruce is a better hitter than these guys. I don't think that's really a question. And he's a more consistent hitter. But he doesn't really have a ton of upside. And I think that the Mets really would have benefited from, I don't know, not being run like a mid to small market team and going out and spending a little bit more to get a Lorenzo Cain or spending a little bit more to get a J.D. Martinez. Or, stay with me here, spending a little bit more and maybe trading away some crappy prospects to get Giancarlo Stanton, or getting multiple players who are, you know, of a Jay Bruce tier, which I don't see them doing at this point. So with all that having been said, Sean, do you, when you go back and look at this, do you think the Mets should have gone in a different direction, or do you think this was probably the right move, despite the fact it's not very interesting bringing back another guy that's been on the team previously?
Well, I think the interesting thing that's being floated out too right now is that they're interested in Lucas Duda as well. And if you signed Lucas Duda and Jay Bruce, not only does that make zero sense, but you could have taken that spending on those two players and sent it directly to Lorenzo Cain. And that would have been a better fit for this outfield long term than anything else. And I understand if you don't think Dominic Smith is what he is. I completely feel the same way. But at the same time, bringing in two lefties to platoon with him makes almost no sense.
Yeah, if that's the case, that's basically saying, like, we're going to give up Dominic Smith to another team for pennies because we don't like this guy, which is fine if they want to say that. I mean, if Duda comes in on a really small contract, I would much rather have him be the starting left-handed first baseman than Dominic Smith, because he has a better track record of performance and his tools are probably better than Smith's at this point. But it's a weird thing, going back to something RJ said before, to run back the same team more or less that just got pounded in 2017. Like, yeah, you know that Syndergaard is likely to come back and have a more productive season, but also likely Michael Conforto is not going to have a 5-win season. And your bullpen doesn't look quite as strong as perhaps it did last year. And you're a year older on guys like Cespedes and Cabrera and even some of the pitchers who have had injury issues. So it seems to me like the Mets are in this comfortable position where they're okay competing for like 80-ish wins. And I'm not sure that I'm comfortable with that. But then again, looking at it from another perspective, do you really want them to go full tank? Do you want them to have a Marlins or Phillies style teardown before they rebuild? And I think that's a tough question to ask ourselves, because I'm not sure I do want this team to tear it down the same way that these other teams do. I don't know if I want to sit through three more years of the Mets, you know, at the bottom of the National League East competing for last place against the Marlins. That's pretty terrible.
I'm always anti-tank, so I would say no. You know, and I guess the only situation where I'm not okay with it, but where I understand it, is if you're like the Marlins, where you've already basically, you know, dismantled your roster. There's no point in kind of just standing pat, with Yelich and Real Muto when you're already looking at, like, what, 60-win season, you know, 65 wins or whatever. So, you know, at that point, sure, unload whatever you have left. But, you know, for a team that could conceivably, like you said, compete for, you know, 80-plus wins, no, I'm not in favor of tanking. You have to get, you know, I don't know. I'm just not a fan of, you know, tearing it down just to tear it down. And even though this team isn't necessarily equipped to make a legitimate run at the Nationals at this point, you know, weird things happen. It's not like any of us expected the Yankees to be as good as they were last season, and they were a win away from the World Series. So there's definitely value, to me at least, in, you know, taking your best shot, or at least taking a shot and seeing if you can, you know, have it bank in or, you know, bounce in or what have you. Now, is it likely? No. But I think, you know, right now we're looking at a league where a lot of these teams who should be taking shots are standing pat, and it doesn't really make sense. You know, what are you trying to do? Are you trying to win? Are you trying to look smart? Or are you trying to save money? You know, I don't know what's going on with, you know, from that perspective, but I don't like it. I don't like the idea of, you know, these teams just being like, all right, well, we're okay, you know, being mediocre because it's better than, you know, spending a little bit more money and perhaps coming up short or what have you. And, you know, the Mets are in that boat. They should definitely go out there and pursue some more talent. You know, Howie Kendrick and Carlos Gomez would still both make sense for this roster, I think. So I don't know. But that's just my weird tangent. Y'all can get back to the Mets talk now.
So, Brian, I do have a question for you. Say we get to May or June or whenever Michael Conforto is supposed to come back, and Brandon Nimmo is just tearing it up, and you have a Nimmo, Cespedes, Bruce, they're all playing well, and of course you can't just not play Conforto. What happens? What the hell do you do from there?
Well, I think that's actually a pretty easy issue in this case, because if Brandon Nimmo's tearing it up, we're on the best possible timeline, and you don't mess with that. So for me, you leave Brandon Nimmo as your everyday center fielder. You leave Jay Bruce in right field. You leave Yonas Cespedes in left field. And given that Michael Conforto's injury is a shoulder injury, I put him at first base instead of Dominic Smith. I don't like the idea of Michael Conforto full-time first baseman as much as I like the idea of Jay Bruce full-time first baseman. But I think given the injury issue, that might be the best solution to the problem that you would have, which would not be a problem. You know, the other thing that the team can do is trade Jay Bruce, or, well, they might not be able to do it in May. They'd have to sit on him for a little while, and that would be bad. But they could trade Dominic Smith. They can trade Brandon Nimmo. If he's tearing it up and he's really that good, maybe the right move at that point is to get a real center fielder back and, you know, reshape the team a little bit. As much as I love Brandon Nimmo and his, you know, potential 400 on base percentage. But at the same time, like, that's not going to happen. Like, Brandon Nimmo might be playing well, and he might be playing well enough to have earned himself a spot with the team. But it seems really unlikely that he'd be on, like, a Aaron Judge or Michael Conforto type tear, which would require him to be playing every day. Even if he's playing well, you can still keep him as a fourth outfielder for a little while until you get to, say, the trade deadline when the Mets, despite Nimmo playing well, are at, you know, 5 or 7 games out and they need to make a move. So you have some time. You can play with it a little bit, I think, especially if, you know, if he is playing that well, you probably don't bring Conforto back as quickly as you would have liked, or you might if the team was doing something differently. You give him some more time to recover and rehab. Something that the Mets have not done a lot of in the past is let guys take the full term when they're recovering from an injury. So that might be a good idea.
So my next question for you now is, let's say they sign Lucas Duda. Dominic Smith doesn't break camp, does he?
Oh, no. I don't think so. I don't think there's any world in which they sign Lucas Duda or Logan Morrison or anybody that they would decide to bring back and bring in as a first baseman, and Dominic Smith breaks camp with the team. I'm sure if that's the case, they trade him off for a C-plus prospect reliever, something like that, add to their collection of cruddy relievers who wouldn't make other teams' 40-man rosters. And you know, he becomes the, I don't know, backup to Ryan Schimpf as first baseman in Tampa Bay, or, you know, something like that. Or he gets packaged with somebody else so that the Mets can get Jake Odorizzi from the Rays, or something weird like that will happen. But yeah, it's a weird situation. I'm like, the more I talk about the Mets and the Dominic Smith and Jay Bruce situation, the less I want to talk about the Mets. Because it's very strange from a front office standpoint. And I really, you know, I don't agree with some of the decisions that they're making, even though Bruce is, like, if you had come to me at the beginning of the season and say, hey, the Mets are going to sign one of the top 15 free agents that you have written up, I'd be like, hey, that's great. That's much more than I would have expected from this team, because they're cheap and they're bad. But if you were going to say of the top 15 free agents, which is the one you'd least like to see end up on the Mets, it would have been probably Jay Bruce first and Eric Hosmer maybe second.
And I wonder how much of this was actually the Mets, like, really, really super wanting Jay Bruce, or Jay Bruce wanting to go back. Because they said, I think the report was that they offered it to him, was it a couple days, like a day before he actually signed, and then he signed almost immediately. So I wonder if it's Bruce just really likes New York, and I mean, from that perspective, good for him. I'm glad. And the problem has never been with Jay Bruce, because, like you said, Jay Bruce is he's played well last year. His deal is probably team friendly. And the problem isn't with him. It's the way he fits in to the roster.
Yeah, I cannot believe that Jay Bruce did not end up on the Giants at this point, because boy, is that outfield terrible. They need two outfielders. They haven't gotten anyone. Like, I just kind of feel at this point, if they don't go out and get J.D. Martinez or Lorenzo Cain, the Giants are going to be really awful. And he seemed to be such a nice fit for that team. But that's kind of another story. I am, like I said before, I'm very tired of talking about Jay Bruce. I've written up three transaction analyses for this guy in the span of like the past year. They've all been basically the same. Oh, wow, what a weird fit. Oh, wow. You know, he's going to the Indians, where he's basically replicates Lonnie Chisenhall, but he's 10% better. Oh, wow, now he's going back to the Mets. I'm over it. It's time to talk about some big time trades. So we'll start off by talking about quickly two, quote, I'm making the air quotes right now, you can't see me, bigger trades that have happened recently. The Padres have traded away Yandervis Solarte. He's heading to Toronto. Coming back the other end are Edward Olivares and Jared Karka. Yeah. This is an interesting deal, and I want to talk about Solarte. So, RJ, give me your thoughts on this move and what this kind of does for the Blue Jays, because the return for the Blue Jays, I don't think, for the Padres, isn't much of worth talking about.
Well, Olivares is supposed to be a somewhat interesting prospect based on his power and speed, but you know, he's a little ways away, and there's no telling how his development will go. That said, I like this for the Blue Jays. You know, Solarte has been, I guess it's kind of stereotypical to call him an underrated player, but you know, basically anyone who plays for the Padres and who isn't a replacement level talent is sort of underrated, because, you know, people just don't talk about them much at all, except for us, because, you know, we had an entire episode dedicated to the Padres for reasons beyond anyone's comprehension. But, you know, he gives them an interesting piece of depth to go along with Aldames Diaz, who they acquired earlier in the offseason, and they really needed some infield coverage, because, you know, Tulowitzki and Travis and even Donaldson had some injury issues last year. And I think it makes a lot of sense to add talent so that you're not so exposed if and when one of those guys goes down. And you could probably argue that Solarte deserves a chance of starting there. And
yeah,
I don't know what their plans are for him necessarily. And, you know, maybe it is in the cards that he will be a starter for them. But he makes a lot of sense. You know, he's a versatile defender. Last season, for instance, even though we think of him as a third baseman, because historically he has been a third baseman, he actually played more games up the middle at shortstop and second base than he did, excuse me, that's combined up the middle. That's not just that, you know, those individual positions, but combined, he played more games at shortstop and second base than he did at third base. They even had him play a little bit of first base. And while he's a switch hitter, he's better against right-handed pitchers, meaning if you're going to platoon him, he's going to receive a lion's share of the playing time. And yeah, he's just a nifty little player. He's also signed to a pretty sweet and team-friendly contract through potentially 2020. And he is in the prime of his career. I mean, he's going to be 31 in July, and yeah, I think it's a nice little deal for the Blue Jays.
I mean, I think the Blue Jays really needed a guy who can hit right-handed pitchers a little bit better. They were very right-handed heavy lineup up to this point. They have switch hitters and Smoke and Morales in the everyday lineup, but he's really the first guy that they've come out and gotten this year who can do some damage to some righties, so that's kind of nice for them. I'm with you 100%. I see this as very different from the Aledmys Diaz acquisition, because Diaz, to me, seemed like the guy who, hey, let's give this guy a flyer and maybe he'll be worth something. Solarte is a legitimate starting second division player, so popping him in for Devin Travis at second base, or as much as I hate to say it, maybe for Troy Tulowitzki at shortstop, could very well be an upgrade. It does give them a little more flexibility if they decide to trade Josh Donaldson, who we now know is worth $23 million this upcoming season, and the Blue Jays may not be willing to pay that. But I really like this, and I have a feeling that even if they were going to commit to Travis as the opening day second baseman, you could play Solarte 4 days a week and really not lose very much by playing him consistently, in terms of, you know, he'd be able to be very productive as a somewhat regular anyway, but I'm kind of with you.
And like you said, he's a legitimate starter, good for 2+ wins a season, I think. And yeah, it's a good deal. It's a nice deal. I don't really have any complaints, even if, you know, Olivares turns into what, you know, his best case scenario is, I think this is an understandable deal for a team that could really use, you know, some more additions, because it seems like they're going to enter the season, which is Donaldson's last season, in a competitive mindset. And if you're going to do that, there's no sense standing pat. You know, obviously you're not going to trade some of the prospects they have at the top of their system or anything like that. So, you know, use some of the mid-tier prospects to load up and see if you can't, if not challenge for the American League East title, at least try to get into the wild card race. And because if you're not doing that, I mean, why are you holding on to Donaldson? Why are you holding on to Marcus Stroman and so on and so forth? So I think if you're the Blue Jays, the worst thing you could do is stand pat. I think you have to be aggressive one way or the other. And it seems like at least by this offseason's standards, they're starting to become aggressive.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I also think that trading Olivares, who's the, you know, the kind of the higher end prospect of this bunch, is not a problem, because this team does have some young outfield talent. They've got Anthony Alford, they've got Dalton Pompey. They have some, you know, the guys you mentioned before who are legitimate, you know, up and coming talents of Lodito and I don't know, Bo Ito. I don't know if that's the best way to put it, but they've got some other guys who will end up moving around the diamond and are eventually going to be replacements for guys like Tulowitzki and Donaldson. So they're a young team. They're kind of on the come up, and I think they had enough prospect depth where dealing away a guy like Olivares to get a good regular today in Solarte doesn't really hurt him too much. Yeah. And I'm way out in front on the Teoscar Hernandez bandwagon. I'm totally down for a full season of that guy in the outfield in Toronto, just to bring that up. Boy, I like watching him hit.
And then our other trade, which was a three-teamer, not something we've gotten to say all season or all winter long, has it? I think this is the first three-team trade. If not, it's the second or the third. But the Dodgers acquired our old friend Scott Alexander, as well as Jake Peter. And the Royals got Trevor Oakes and Eric Mahia. And the White Sox got Joaquim Soria, Luis Avalon, $1 million from the Royals and $2 million from the Dodgers. Brian, this is a blockbuster deal. Which side did you like the most?
The Dodgers side. I don't know how you not like the Dodgers side the most, because Scott Alexander is probably the best player in this deal. He was really good last year. I think there was a post on Fangraphs where they called him like the mini Zach Britton. That's a little going a little far, but he's a good left-handed reliever on a team that needs a good left-handed reliever. I mean, Tony Watson's probably on his way out, but Tony Cingrani is a good left-hander. And right now I think that gives them two really good left-handed options in their bullpen between Cingrani and Alexander. If you know that anything about the Dodgers, you know that they want to have at least four or five lefties good to go at any point in their bullpen and in their starting rotation, and on the 15-day DL, if possible. So it's a team that's totally focused on getting as many good pitchers as possible. And they turned Luis Avalon, who I like. I actually like Avalon just fine. But I think they upgraded on him to add Alexander to the bullpen, and that's the big thing that matters here.
Yeah, and because it's the Dodgers and because of Scott Alexander, because, you know, you mentioned the – hyperbole, let's say, of calling him, you know, Zach Britton Light. I will remind everyone that, you know, Scott Alexander is entering his age 28 season, and around this time last year, there was a lot of hype, let's put it that way, about a left-handed pitcher who was sort of similar age, sort of a similar story, that being Grant Dayton. You know, a lot of hype about, you know, he had like a 6.5 strikeout to walk ratio and, you know, 20 something appearance, convinced him and his rising fastball would reliever. And you know what happened? He's actually a member of the Braves now, because he did not pitch well when he was healthy, and then he got hurt and underwent Tommy John surgery. And I'm just saying, it's a little surprising to me that the Royals did trade Scott Alexander, because again, he looked very good last year, but it's not that surprising to me. And I guess I'm just a little bit shocked that this is all they got in return, you know, Oakes and Mahia. But I don't know, I guess I'm agreeance with you that the Dodgers are the best part of this deal, but I think there's probably a little bit more risk with Alexander than we're willing to admit. And this goes back to the fact that everyone is so obsessed with bullpens nowadays that we've kind of forgotten that, hey, just because a guy has, you know, 70 good innings, 80 good innings under his belt doesn't necessarily mean he's going to continue to pitch to that level, because, I mean, who knows? Alexander wasn't exactly a name that we were – too keen on, you know, just a few months ago when he was potentially closing games for the Royals. So a lot can change in, you know, 6 months' time, and it wouldn't surprise me if in a year, you know, the Alexander hype proves to be as wasteful as the Dayton hype. But it also wouldn't surprise me if Alexander settles in and has a pretty good career for the Dodgers as a, you know, setup type. So I guess what I'm saying is relievers be wild.
Yeah, even Alexander. Alexander's kind of a lefty specialist. He's a ground ball ace. That's what he does. He gets ground balls. So he's not the strikeout risk that Dayton was, but he is still a performance risk, just like you said. The one reason why I see why maybe the Royals might have wanted to make this move is they saved a lot of money by kicking Joaquin Soria to the curb. And now, given the what we've called maybe the collusion-ish free agent market this year, it really does seem like a possibility that this Royals team could be bringing back, if not all of their big-time free agents this offseason, they could be bringing back at least more of them than they expected a few months ago. I wouldn't be surprised at all at this point to see both Mike Moustakas and Eric Hosmer return to Kansas City. And if that's the case, that's what this deal might have been more about, is clearing up a little 2018 payroll so that they can afford to bring back some of their, you know, more important stars. And when you look at it from that perspective, Scott Alexander is probably not a bad price to pay if it means that you can bring back two players or three players, and if you know, depending on how things go, out of a pool of position players who you really value.
Should they do that, though? Should they go out there and bring back Moustakas and potentially Hosmer?
No. It's not what I would do if I were the Royals, but at the same time, like, if I were the Royals, I would be like, wow, I miss that Eric Hosmer guy. But if I was really looking to rebuild the team and try to do something in more of a win-now mode, I would be looking at some other free agents. I'd be looking at Jake Arrieta. I'd be looking at J.D. Martinez, instead of trying to go after a Mike Moustakas or an Eric Hosmer at positions that have a little bit more depth. I mean, they could probably go out and they could re-sign Moustakas and Hosmer. Or, conversely, they could probably go out and get Jake Arrieta, Lucas Duda, Todd Frazier, and another piece. And to me, that would probably be a shorter-term commitment. It would probably make the team better as a whole for next year. It would probably be something where they could readjust in 2019 if things still don't work out. So if they want to win now, I'm not entirely sure that bringing back their old players might be the best option there. But it's not about what I want. And that's what I've learned about this offseason. It's not about what we want. It's about what the front offices and ownership groups want. And I think they may want to bring back Hosmer and Moustakas. Or maybe
about compromise, Brian.
No. No, we're not a compromising group of fans and analysts.
Ain't that the truth? And I don't think we have anything else to say here. Like, the White Sox get some, you know, actually, you know what? I'm wrong, because I think you do have something else to say about a certain White Sox reliever here. But I'm fine with them getting, you know, two veteran relievers and some cash in exchange for, you know, Jake Peter, who did not seem to be in their plans, didn't seem to have a role in that organization, and was willing to be Rule 5 eligible after this coming season. So they basically cashed him in and got some veteran help who they'll probably spend at the deadline for more than Jake Peter. So, Brian, take it away. This is the moment you've been waiting for all show.
It really isn't. I do like the move for the White Sox. I think it's smart. It's a smart move for the White Sox. Luis Avalon's a perfectly fine left-handed pitcher. He was a little injured at the end of last year, and that's always a warning sign. And Joaquin Soria's got closing experience, which is great, because I don't think the White Sox have any relievers right now. I mean, they were leaning pretty heavily on Danny Farcar last year, to give you some idea of how bad their bullpen's likely to be this year. So, I mean, somebody's got to throw 100 innings in middle relief for this team, and it might as well be these two guys. Absorbing the salary probably doesn't hurt him, of Joaquin Soria. I just think that this is probably an underrated move for them, because I don't really think they gave up very much. I'm not a big Jake Peter guy, and they've got some assets, and there's a fine chance that Luis Avalon pitches absolutely well this year and does exactly what you said he will, that he brings back somebody better than Jake Peter in return and gives him half a season of decent relief in the exchange. So from the White Sox perspective, it seems like a no-brainer. From the Dodgers perspective, I kind of liked Oaks, so I kind of you know, think that they gave up something legitimate to get Alexander. And but I can certainly see why the Dodgers did it. It's just the Royals that I have a little bit more questionable understanding of why they made this deal.
And that's all I think either of us have to say about that. So, Brody, why don't you throw us some batting practice here?
You want some batting practice? Well, I got Boone Logan teed up for you. So, Boone Logan to the Milwaukee Brewers. He signed for 1 year, and the deal is kind of weird. $1.875 million in 2018. With a $4.125 million club option in 2019. He has $3.2 million in incentives each year, but because of his buyout in 2019, it is 1 year, $2.5 million.
This is sort of interesting in the sense that all of Milwaukee's signings this offseason have been interesting, and that's that, you know, you look at Boone Logan and you think of him as a left-handed specialist, and that's probably all he will be, even though, you know, he's had some weird blips, because, you know, every loogie has weird blips. It's just part of the job. That said, the most interesting thing about Logan to me is that last season, in a very small sample size of 35 plate appearances, he struck out 12 of the right-handed batters he faced and walked only two. That's a 6, you know, strikeout-to-walk ratio. Nothing notable there, except that's by far the best performance he's had against righties in his career over any sample size. And, you know, just to give you perspective, his career numbers, even with that 6.0 ratio baked in, is 1.57. So is this the sign of Boone Logan changing and maybe becoming a two-way threat? Absolutely not. It's almost certainly, you know, a small sample size thing, but I don't know. That's the most interesting thing I could say here. Otherwise, you know, use him against lefties and he'll be okay.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with the Logan signing, especially considering that it is a relatively low-cost signing. But he's also been pretty bad for 3 out of the last 4 seasons. If you look at DRA, he has only cracked 4.7 once, and that was in 2016 with Colorado. I just don't really see him as making a big impact, but every team needs a lefty specialist. And even with Logan being used in that kind of manner, he still kind of gives up enormous batting average on balls in play regularly. He strikes out a ton of guys, but he also gets hit pretty hard when he gets hit. So he's not going to change the face of the Brewers bullpen. That having been said, you know, there's virtually no downside to this deal. If he pitches well, great. Then they got what they paid for. If he doesn't pitch well, great. They kind of got what they paid for. So good on the Brewers. Good on Boone Logan. I hope he does well this year, but I'm not exactly holding my breath.
So, another reliever we got signing for you, Craig Stammen to the Padres, 2 years, $4.5 million.
I mean, good for him, because wasn't it during this, I think it was during last season, we talked about, I don't think it was the Padres episode, I think it was before that, we talked about, you know, our favorite guy who had made the roster, who you were kind of surprised by or what have you, and I believe Brian took Stammen because, you know, he missed the entire 2016 season, he had barely pitched in 2015, and he comes back, and I don't think a lot of people realized he had a 1.32 ERA plus. You know, he had a solid strikeout to walk ratio, and you know, he was a multi-inning pitcher out of the bullpen for a team that really needed that length. And here they're rewarding him on a low-cost deal. And you know, whenever he's been healthy, he has posted good ERAs. And I know there's more to pitching than posting good ERAs, but you know, not really. You know, in a sense, if you're able to consistently keep runs off the board, well, that's the point of it. It doesn't necessarily matter how you do it, so long as you do it over a long enough period to prove it's sustainable. So, yeah, this is good for him, and it's a nice story. And, you know, the Padres also rewarded Clayton Richard during late parts of the year, and this seems like a similar deal where they're, you know, giving a contract to a guy who proved himself useful, proved himself, you know, perhaps about more valuable to a rebuilding team than anyone else because of his versatility and because of his, you know, persistence throughout his career. He's a guy who the younger players can look to and say, you know what, if he can get through that, I can get through, you know, this rut or whatever. So I think there's value in this beyond that. And also, you know, we're talking about $4 million over 2 years to a middle reliever. It's really not a big deal at all. So this is just sort of another sign of how boring the offseason is that I'm ranting about this deal and not, you know, something more impactful and meaningful.
This is me giving both RJ and myself a well-deserved round of applause. I get so much wrong, even though I consider myself a decent baseball analyst. I get so much wrong. To finally be so vindicated with Craig Stammen, like, this really, it hits me right in the heart. Yeah, I fortunately made the guess that Stammen would be the best pitcher this year to not appear in the Baseball Prospectus annual. And I was, like, almost right. Only his teammate Dinelson Lamet was better out of pitchers that didn't show up in our 2017 Baseball Prospectus annual. That having been said, he was fine last year. He wasn't great. But one of the things that he does pretty well is he pitches multiple innings in relief. He pitched 80 innings last year, which is pretty good for a guy who only showed up in 60 games. I'm thrilled. I couldn't be happier. He's not, like, great by any great stretch of the imagination. He's got a relatively pedestrian strikeout per nine, and he doesn't do any one thing particularly well. He's a pretty good ground ball reliever, but he's solid enough that if you can get him on a under $5 million contract for 2 years, as long as he stays moderately healthy, he's going to be a productive, like, he's exactly the kind of guy you want throwing in the sixth or seventh inning for a team, even if it is the Padres. So good on him. Good on me. Good on everybody involved in the Craig Stammen thing, I feel so, like.
I'm going to take you a little step farther with that one. He really developed a sinker last year, and that was pretty crucial to him pitching well. Playing in front of that infield defense in San Diego, he might be a little even better than we think. Might he not?
Well, I mean, that infield defense last year was not good. And now he's got Freddy Galvis behind him. We have no idea what's going to be going on with their first base situation. Solarte being gone. Solarte was never really like a plus defender at any position other than third base. So, yeah, maybe their infield defense gets a little bit better this year. That could be kind of interesting. But, you know, as much as I got excited about him pitching well last year, he's still Craig Stammen. I mean, who cares?
He's still Craig Stammen. That's a great segue now to Rene Rivera signing with the Los Angeles Angels. 1 year. $2.8 million. Brian, friend of the show.
Yeah, I mean, Rene Rivera is a going concern for yourself and myself as a former New York Met. I have not disliked a single move the Angels have made this offseason. It sounds stupid. I feel silly saying that, oh, another good move by the Angels, but he's exactly the type of second or third catcher that this team could really use behind Martin Maldonado. I think he'll be just fine, and he's relatively inexpensive. So he's a guy who gets a lot of credit for his defense, and it's well-deserved. So I think this is a good pickup.
Yeah, he's good at basically everything behind the plate. He has a good arm, good at receiving the ball, seemingly a good staff handler as well. And, you know, offensively, that's not his calling card whatsoever. I know last year he finished with, like, a 92 OPS plus because of his strong play and, like, 20 games with the Cubs. You know, has a hitch in his swing, but he does have some poolside power. Probably going to take you out, 8 to 10 times. I'm talking about home runs there. Otherwise, he's really aggressive at the plate. You're not going to see him walk a ton, but you're not paying Rene Rivera for his offense, and you're not playing him for his offense. You're doing both of those things because of his work behind the plate, and he's a nice complement to Martin Maldonado. They're kind of similar mold, and I was a big fan of Maldonado and a fan of Rene Rivera, and like he said, the Angels haven't made a bad move all winter, I don't think, and it doesn't seem like they were going to upgrade over Maldonado, so getting basically a clone of him to add depth and to cover you in case Maldonado gets injured or what have you is a pretty smart move on their part, I think.
So, we are down to the end. Adonis Garcia released from the Braves, and Taylor Jungman released from the Brewers.
Yeah, so we'll start with Garcia because there was a point not too long ago where he seemed like a pretty decent find by the Braves front office. Between 2015 and 2016, he received something like, I think it was more than 700 plate appearances, had an OPS plus in the 96 range, I want to say 97 range. And, he wasn't anything special. He was a guy who, just could hit some home runs, hit for a decent average, didn't really walk or anything, but, he didn't have a good glove, so that was always a downside. But, he looked like a pretty solid find for a minor league free agent who had never gotten a shot with the Yankees organization. That said, last season he just completely fell apart. finished the year well below replacement level, I believe. And, you know, he's older than everyone anticipates, because you always expect these minor league free agent types to be like, you know, maybe 28, 29. Well, he was, but now he's nearing 33. So realistically, you know, what are you banking on there? You're not banking on him rebounding or anything. So let the guy go overseas, make more money, and, you know, enjoy the experience of living someplace other than Atlanta or whatever minor league towns he lived in over the years. Do you have anything to add about Adonis Garcia, Ryan? Because I don't think you do. I think I kind of said everything that possibly could be said about Adonis Garcia just then.
You really did. I think the only thing else that I would have said is that if Adonis Garcia had been with the Braves last year, it would have been a really bad sign for the Braves. So, yeah, he's a guy that really brought no value to that team as they try to climb out of their hole. So you hit everything. As far as Taylor Youngman, you know, he might be disappointed that he's already on his way out of affiliated ball after, you know, what many would consider a disappointing season in Double and Triple A last year. I mean, he pitched poorly in Double A. He started in Triple A, but didn't really get any traction there. He did all right. He had a 2.59 ERA. So yeah, he's actually a relatively recent guy. He's relatively young for a guy to be going over to pitch overseas. So, you know, he might be a little torn up, a little frustrated about this being potentially the end of his major league career. And to that, I would just say, young men, there's no need to be down.
All righty then. And I would say the other people who were probably down about this are Brewers fans, because if you remember, they took Youngman with the 12th pick in the 2011 draft, and a few picks later, at number 15, they took Jed Bradley. So they got a pair of collegiate pitchers, and neither one of them worked out. And, you know, you could sit here and say, well, who do they really miss on? Because, you know, George Springer went ahead of them, Anthony Rendon went ahead of them, Lindor obviously went ahead of them, and so on and so forth. But, you know, Jose Fernandez was picked a couple of slots after Youngman. You had Sonny Gray, who was picked a couple slots after Bradley. And you go through the rest of the first round, bring up Colton Wong and Joe Panik and Jackie Bradley Jr., Michael Fulmer, Trevor Story. So, you know, just in the first round, there were about a handful of players who would have made significantly more impact on the Brewers had they been drafted and developed the same way as they were with their actual teams. But, yeah, that's just a disappointing – another disappointment for the Brewers, player development under Doug Melvin in the last stages of his tenure there, because, you know, you have two picks in the top 15. You're expecting one of them to work out to be a decent, you know, player. And as it turns out, their stints with the Brewers will end with a combined 36 games in the majors, which is obviously not what the Brewers wanted whatsoever. So,
no, I think that's a really good point. Much better than my kind of flippant, you know, Village People joke that I made at their expense. But
who are the Village People?
But yeah, no, this is not exactly how things were meant to work out. At the same time, like, you know, this is kind of the 40-man roster spot that flips over to the Boone Logan deal. So, you know, this is the cost of bringing in a pitcher with the pedigree and the talent of Boone Logan. So, I mean, who's really complaining about that when the guy you bring in is so talented?
Yep, and you can really tell that we are scraping the barrel for transactions to talk about, because we have spent a significant amount of time on Boone Logan, Jed Bradley, and Taylor Youngman, and the New York Mets as a whole. So somebody's got to make some moves, man. This is getting ridiculous. I mean, it's beyond the point of ridiculous. This is getting dire, I would say.
Yeah, I think that's a good term for it. It is pretty dire. We have, I think on my top 20 free agents, I think there's still at least like 10 of them available. We've got Darvish, Hosmer, Martinez, Kane, Cobb, Arrieta, Lance Lynn, and then Mike Moustakas, Greg Holland, Todd Frazier, and Jason Vargas and Addison Reed. So that's well more than 10 of my top 20 free agents. But more importantly, these are guys who, like, if you look at some of the depth charts for different teams at this point, it just looks like baseball is going to be horrible this year, aside from like three or four teams. So because there's all this talent that's still freely available, you've got like a legitimate, decent barnstorming team that can be made up of the available free agents at this point.
Yep, which is not what you want to hear as, you know, vans are starting. Well, they're not being packed yet, but they're like what, 3 weeks away from being packed for spring training, and whew, we are in trouble.
So I have one quick question. I just want to stick on the Brewers for a minute, because you mentioned that they've had a little difficulty with some of their drafting recently. What was the last good first-round draft pick that the Brewers had, do you think?
Well, I am inclined to think it was probably Ryan Braun, because you would not ask this question otherwise. But now that I have to think about Brewers draft picks, we're talking major league only, right? We're not including prospects or guys who were...
Like, Keston Hiura was the guy they took last year, and
yes,
he could very well be excellent, but he's a little bit of a ways away. But even before 2017, if you look at some of their recent draft picks, it hasn't all been that great.
Right. Was it Braun, though, or is it someone I'm just
so
overthinking?
I would say Braun is easily the best, but since Braun, the only other major leaguers that have come out of their draft have been Jeremy Jeffress, Matt LaPorta, Jake Odorizzi, Brett Lowry. So all of these are guys that have been successful with teams other than the Brewers. And the only other first-round pick anytime recently who seems to either be, you know, on his way up or producing in the major leagues of any value is Mitch Haniger, who, again, isn't a Brewer. Yeah. You know, a lot of the guys they've drafted recently haven't looked particularly impressive, like Corey Ray. Trent Clark is still around, but, you know, you don't know what you're going to get out of him. So it's been a long trip in the desert for this team since the – I guess Lowry was the last good draft pick they've had.
Yeah, and, I mean, you didn't even mention Dylan Covey, and, you know, he made his big league debut last season through 70 innings of 7.71 ERA ball for the White Sox. So that kind of tells you – it's not a good sign, I guess, when I'm referencing Dylan Covey in terms of your recent drafts, and you can kind of consider him a success because he actually reached the majors. That's reuse the word I just used, that's dire.
Yeah, I think that this is payback from their stretch between 1999 and 2005, because between 99 and 2005, they drafted Ben Sheets, Prince Fielder, Ricky Weeks, and Ryan Braun, and then the baseball gods said, okay, that's enough, guys. You have to have a really crappy run of things for the next 10 or 12 years.
Yep, that sounds right. And, I mean, before that, they drafted, what, Jeff Jenkins, and well, I guess that was 95, so never mind. I was thinking he was a little closer to the Ben Sheets draft date, but no. So, yeah, that's a depressing thing. And, you know, that's not really something that this franchise can withstand. You know, they kind of have to be able to develop their own talent because they're not going to be able to flex the payrolls of some of the bigger market squads. So, when the drafting is good, the Milwaukee Brewers are good, and when it's not, they have to, you know, strip it down. And well, you know what, that franchise is really well positioned, I think, for the near term. Good farm system. They have an interesting amount of talent on their big league roster. Like, I was surprised by the Domingo Santana trade rumors because, you know, he seems underrated to me. He was the best hitter on that team last year, according to OPS Plus, and you know, he's still pretty cheap. And it's just interesting because they have a lot of outfield depth. So I'm kind of curious to see what they do. I just would have said the same thing like 2 months ago, and I would have expected them to have done something by now other than bringing back Giovanni Gallardo and, you know, adding bit pieces like Logan and whatnot. Didn't they add another starting pitcher too? I know we didn't talk about it because it was just not a, you know, not a thing for us. But I believe they added one other starting pitcher in addition to Gallardo. He's slipping the top of my head here. Who was it? It was
How dare you?
I'm struggling here. Who was the pitcher they added beyond Gallardo?
He was Ulysse Chacin, another
ongoing concern of
mine. Brilliant signing by the Brewers because he's a guy that I really like and another former Padre. So, I think that – but, yeah, Ulysse Chacin and Boone Logan does not an offseason make. I don't think there's any question that this is a team that – you know, we had talked about, I think it was on a podcast that you weren't available for, that we talked about, you know, this is a team that really needs Jake Arrieta. It's a team that really needs an impact starting pitcher. And until that move gets made, it's kind of, you know, you think that they're probably going to be in that tier below really contending for the wild card.
Yeah, that's – well, but we'll see, though. I mean, there's still not literally – well, yeah, kind of literally an entire offseason to go here. Maybe they go add someone. Who knows? Who knows if anyone's going to add anyone? Maybe there's no new signings the rest of the way, and we just kind of forget that Yu Darvish exists by June.
The last thing I heard was that JD Martinez was talking about signing during spring training, which is as crazy as baseball gets.
So, speaking of Yu Darvish, somebody actually just tweeted at him to take the Yankees' offer, quote tweeted and said, they didn't give me an offer yet. So my question to y'all, do we think that Yu Darvish is going to break his own signing whenever it happens?
Yes.
I hope so.
Absolutely.
That would be...
It's going to be great.
That would be amazing.
And honestly, at this point, I'm looking at some of the more aggressive teams this offseason and seeing if they might be, you know, some dark horse candidates for somebody like Darvish this offseason. Like, there's so many teams that are being so passive. I wonder if it's one of the other teams that's already gone out and gotten a Shohei Ohtani or a Giancarlo Stanton, or it's going to be one of those teams that goes out and tries to make the move for Darvish, because I'm shocked to think that some of these other teams have not made him a good enough offer to pull him off the market.
Well, isn't the theory behind a cap, right, is that when bigger teams hit the cap, then the smaller teams start picking up the pace. Well, smaller teams haven't picked up the pace. The bigger teams have just shifted over to the trade market, which takes smaller teams out from the trade market anyway. So that's what I think is bonkers to me about this whole thing, is that big teams aren't not doing moves. They're just going to the places that the smaller teams already did the moves.
Yeah, sort of. I mean, why haven't the Dodgers made a FU offer to Darvish yet? I mean, they're a team with some money. They've got legitimate money. Why haven't the Red Sox made an FU offer to JD Martinez or Darvish or somebody else? So there's a couple of big market teams that are not, you know, playing in the deep end of the pool like they normally do, I think. And I think a lot of that has to do with discussions about trades for Stanton or trades for Machado or, you know, other outside factors going on, or maybe collusion stuff. Who knows? But it's a weird offseason, and it's a little disappointing that our first offseason as the DFA podcast is kind of delayed with these different moves, and we can't talk a little bit more excitedly about some of them, but we'll survive, I'm sure.
I'm not so sure, but I think that's a good place to end it. So, Brian, you want to do your thing, maybe sell some books here?
Yeah, we can sell some books. So the 2018 Baseball Prospectus Annual is now available for pre-order. You can go to Amazon or even more, hopefully, your local bookstore and tell them that you want a copy of it. It's going to be very good, despite my contributions to it. It'll contain lots of information, and everybody should buy at least one copy, preferably in hardcover, because that version of the book can be used as a small house if you need it. It's very large and very durable. So please buy the book.
And it will be including Craig Stammen this year?
I guess you'll have to wait and find out. Spoiler alert, yes, it will be including Craig Stammen. Beyond that, we are DFA Podcast. You can find us on Twitter at DFA Podcast. You can email us at dfapodcast@baseballprospectus.com. You can read all of RJ's work at CBS Sports MLB. You can read all of Sean's work pretty much nowhere right now, but eventually at Beyond the Border and BP Mets. You can listen to Sean's work on this very show that you're listening to right now. You can find me at Baseball Prospectus. And we appreciate you very, very much for listening and bearing through this cold, dark offseason with us. So, anything else you guys want to share with our dearest listeners before we call it a show?
No. I mean, we have nothing here. We're tapped out.
we're going to be sitting under rocks for 3 more weeks until someone signs.
Somebody please trade Gerrit Cole. There were like 5 minutes a couple of days ago. We were like, oh, man, we're going to get a Gerrit Cole to the Astros trade. Things are going to be good. And then nothing. So
the offseason, remember, it was 2018.
Yeah. So far, 2018, bad start, but we'll be back next week. So we will talk to you then.